Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Bridget English, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, I'm talking to Joseph Tracy, co-author along with Declan Ward and John Cahill of Safety as We Watch, Anesthesia in Ireland, 1947 to 1998, which describes the individual innovators, institutions, and networks which led to the development of anesthesia in Ireland. The book traces the fascinating development of anesthesia from an apprentice-based craft to a highly technical medical specialty. Welcome, Joe. First, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you came to this project.
Thanks very much, Bridget, for inviting me to speak to that. I have to correct you immediately. It's 1847 to 1998, not 1947 to 1998.
You're right.
I live here. I'm Irish, and I live here in Dublin. I'm a graduate of University College Dublin, graduated in medicine from there in 1974. And I trained in anesthesia initially in Dublin and then in McGill in Montreal and then finished off in the Beth Israel, one of the Harvard hospitals in Boston, before I returned to Ireland to take up a consultant post. I worked as a consultant at Beaumont Hospital, which is one of the larger hospitals in Dublin. And I worked there for over 30 years. And I also worked as in a parallel universe as director of the National Poisons Information Centre for Ireland. And I retired from medical practice in 2010. So we had to find something to do. The other authors, the lead author is really Declan Ward. And I met Declan yesterday to talk about this. And he said he had a very unusual interaction with the University of Illinois. On Good Friday in 1973, which is pretty well 50 years ago, he told his mother he was going to play a soccer match against the University of Illinois here in Dublin. And she said, no good will come of that, you going out to play on Good Friday. And she was right. He suffered a severe head injury, doesn't remember anything about the second half of the match, was carted off with a fractured skull thanks to a boot from somebody from Illinois. However, he recovered fully, as you can see from the book, and trained in anesthesia and surgery first and then anesthesia and in Dublin. And then he did, like myself, he traveled to Toronto Sick Children's and came back as a pediatric anesthetist to one of the pediatric hospitals, which is called Temple Street on the north side of Dublin. The third author is John Cahill, and he trained initially in the UK and then came back to Ireland. And he worked in Cork, down in the south of the country, in the Mercy Hospital there until he retired as well. So the three of us are retirees. How we came to the project. In 2016, the then president of the College of Anaesthetists of Ireland, Professor Carson, approached the three of us and said, would we be willing to write a history of anesthesia and of the faculty of anesthesis of RCSI and of anesthesia in Ireland. To be honest, we were all a little bit reluctant because it seemed to be a very broad palette. And then we did agree, though in retrospect, I think we were right to be reluctant because the whole project took over 6 years from inception to publication. So that's how we got into this.
Right. That's really interesting, especially since poor Declan was wounded so badly in the soccer match against University of Illinois. But I'm very glad to hear he recovered anyway. this is the first. I was really interested to discover because I've read and researched some books about anesthesia in the U.S. But I was interested to hear that this is the first published history of anesthesia, about anesthesia in Ireland. So can you speak a little bit about, I know you said it took 6 years to publish this, but about the challenges and maybe some of the pleasures or joys of writing this kind of book?
Well, firstly, as you state, this is the first published history of anesthesia in Ireland. Now, as a sort of a prologue, about 2014, Professor Wilkinson, who's a well-known English medical historian specializing in anesthesia, came to Dublin and he gave a talk, a very comprehensive talk, at the Royal Irish Academy of Medicine here in Dublin on the history of anesthesia in Ireland. And then he challenged us in the audience, particularly Declan and myself, with the very point that nothing, not a single article had been published as far as he knew in any of the anesthesia journals on this very subject. So it had got us started thinking about it anyway at that point before Professor Carson came along and actually said that they would support us in doing this. So we started with a complete clean slate. We didn't have to, you know, see what was written already because there was nothing written already. The College of Anesthetists, as it was then, left it completely up to us as to what we were going to include and what we were going to exclude. They didn't say we had to go from here to there or anything like that. As soon as the word, of course, got out that somebody was writing a history of anesthesia, we started getting a lot of advice from all quarters as to who should be in this book. And we realized that this could be a bit of a slippery slope, you know, who do you put in and who do you leave out? Because obviously it could be an endless tale. So for this reason, we decided we'd have a cutoff date. Now, one of the editors told me to have as many dead people in the book as possible because that's, from the point of view of being sued, it's very safe, but we couldn't do that. So we set the cutoff date as the foundation date of the College of Anesthetists, which is now called the College of Anesthesiologists. So that set the cutoff date as 1998, which was the year of when we stopped being a faculty of anesthetists of the Royal College of Surgeons and became an independent college. It also gave us about 20 years of retrospection, so we weren't looking at dates that were too recent because they're not. You can't really look at them impartially if dates are too close or the current. We found that would not be good for history. The start date was quite obvious. It was going to be January of 1847, which is the date of the first anaesthetic given in Ireland. So that gave us a nice span of about 150 years to cover. Dr. Ward wrote a preliminary chapter, though, chapter one, which really wants to lay out what was happening on the world stage before first anaesthetic came here. And he dealt with a number of the important characters like Wells and Morton so that we had the background. And then chapter two is about the first anaesthetic here. As the book evolved, you know, we began to realize, you know, there's regional anesthesia, there's general anesthesia, there's critical care, and there's so many different aspects. So we were adamant that we were not going to try and do a textbook because, I mean, it's just an enormous task. And we would be writing about the development of different drugs, different inhalation agents, different techniques. And that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to describe the people, the personages that were involved in anesthesia growing as a specialty, and then also the institutions. So we kept away from, as much as we could, we had to have technical aspects in it as well. But we try to keep away from all of that. And most of these drugs were invented elsewhere anywhere, so they weren't really part of our remit. So we decided to concentrate on the people and the institutions. It soon became obvious that the developments in the 19th century would be covered by Dr. Declan Ward, because he has an expertise in older history and he knew his way around the archives better than any of us. And John Cahill and myself would deal with the various institutions, the societies, the faculties, the exams, and so on. I had been very involved in the faculty and I knew I'd actually met every single one of the deans in my lifetime. So I felt this was an area I could write about with honesty because I knew all of the personalities or had met them maybe in an exam and they'd failed me, but I'd met every one of them face to face. So we now had reached a point where there were really two parts of the book. There was the early history from the 19th century and then there was the 20th century. We'd also decided that we'd write biographies of key people as we saw them. Now, there was going to be, obviously, there was going to be the deans, and then there was going to be the professors, and then we picked out various historical people that we felt were should be included. And this, in the end, became the third part of the book. We really did feel that part of our task, apart from writing the book, was to provide archival material to have some of these biographies written down for next generations, for want of another word. We divided these biographies between us, depending on who knew what characters or, you know, people who are interested in certain characters. For the people who are still alive, we used everything. We used face-to-face meetings. We used written information received from them, like CVs, and also telephone calls if they were in another part of the country. The parts I really enjoyed were, for instance, writing the chapter on the first anesthesia, but really on how the information came from Boston over to England and then from England over to Ireland. But, of course, we ran into the two major problems that we ran into. The first one was getting high-quality images that we could use in the book with adequate number of pixels and also in getting copyright permission. There were some images that we couldn't use because it was too difficult to get copyright, or we couldn't identify who actually owned the copyright, or else if it was some of the larger publishing houses, the amount of paperwork involved was just so complex that we sort of threw a towel in at it. And some of them were wanting to charge so much money that we said, oh, we'll get a different image from somewhere else. Then, of course, the one that was looming on the horizon or nobody saw it coming was COVID. So COVID came at the point where we had a lot of the writing done, but we hadn't it all done. But it was at the point where we had copy editors and we wanted to go back and check on references and things like that. So the major archives that we used, that was the archives of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, the archives of the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, the National Library, and various other ones, like they were all closed. They were closed for the duration of COVID. And so we had to wait till they opened. In another case, like the Public Records Office of Northern Ireland, which is in Belfast, it was closed initially, but when it opened, we couldn't go there because the restrictions were so severe. I lived in Dublin, but I wasn't allowed to travel more than 5 kilometres. So I wasn't allowed to travel north for a number of months before I could get up there. So that delayed things as well. So all of these slowed down the final part of the book. So there was quite a few challenges, as you can see, thrown in there.
Right, and they're familiar challenges. They sound like to a lot of academic writing. I know that so much archival material was cut off during the COVID pandemic, as well as the struggle with images is familiar to me as well, because of the high cost of them often. And it's interesting the way you also chose to divide the book between the first half is roughly the development in the 19th century, and then the ways it was managed in the 20th.
You actually asked about the networks of information and things like that.
Right. So the especially since I think that you've highlighted, you know, the beginning of the book at least highlights how compounds like chloroform and ether.
Chloroform and ether, yeah.
Right, and how they were used. But I was interested in the networks between, say, England, Scotland, and Ireland, and how maybe information was circulated, and also how the developments might have been different in different places.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. And see, the Act of Union took place in 1801, and it meant that from then on, Ireland had no parliament. So the members of parliament in Ireland now had to travel to Westminster. But this actually led to very good connections between Dublin and London in particular, because there was a good ferry service from Dublin over to Holyhead in Wales. And then the railway lines were built between Holyhead and Westminster. So MPs could get to Westminster in under 24 hours. So, I mean, if we go right back to the chapter two, which is the beginning of the story in Ireland, the medical networks were really, as today to an extent, well, now we have computers, but were the journals. So the information about the ether anesthesia in Boston, and then the first use of it in England, all of this came together very tightly. As soon as Liston heard about the Boston experiment, he went and he did an amputation, and he did that at the end of the year. But it was written up in the British and Foreign Medical Review, which was sort of the international journal at the time. Now, that it was written up in the January edition of that journal, but the January edition arrived in Dublin around Christmas. So the surgeon, John MacDonald, actually saw the article about Morton's anesthetic and about Liston's surgery. He saw it in December, which was very quick. It was all within, the slow part was actually coming from Boston to Dublin. And the only reason that was slow was because the surgeon who wrote the article wanted to see a whole lot of cases before he was willing to endorse it and write an article. And then that was published in one of the Boston papers, and then that was sent to England by steamship. But once he wrote it, it got here very quickly, within a couple of weeks. And then from London to here, it was only two weeks, I think, for the information to travel. So John MacDonald actually gave the first anaesthetic on the 1st of January, based on the information he got from the January edition of the British and Foreign Medical Review. So that was pretty good communication. Now, something similar happened then as regards chloroform. Simpson used chloroform at the beginning of November in Edinburgh, and he wrote a pamphlet on how to use it. And he was also known to be in touch with a lot of obstetricians in Dublin by post. And so as a result of that, the first chloroform anaesthetic was given in Dublin by the end of November. So he did it beginning of November. By the end of November, they were using chloroform in Dublin. Immediately, though, about in January of that year, the first death occurred under chloroform anaesthesia. And this triggered a lot of anxiety. And it triggered a lot of different groups looking at the risks involved in using ether and the risks involved in using chloroform. And you see that even right back to the very first cases in the States. They wanted to see a couple of cases before they started using this chemical to see if it was safe for their patients. And for instance, in October of 1861, there was a report from Boston. It was called the Report of a Committee of the Boston Society of Medical Improvement on the Inherent Dangers of the Vapors of Sulfuric Ether. So they were always very concerned about the safety of these agents. Now, it's interesting because the northeastern states, I presume the New England states is what they meant, but the northeastern states continued to use ether. And that was the first drug used in the one used in Boston was ether. So they were loyal to the ether. But in Britain and Ireland, it was mainly chloroform. But chloroform was easier to use. But as it turned out, it was an awful lot more dangerous. And eventually people moved away from it, or they started using a combination of these things. So word did spread around the medical community at an amazing rate, really, considering there was no telephone calls or anything like that. So I thought it was a good question from you about that.
Yeah, because it's especially interesting that, like as you say, that ether was used more in North America and chloroform was used more in Ireland. And then you have so much interesting information as well about the organizations and academic developments that kind of happened in correlation with the development of anesthesia. So particularly, I think, chapter 13, you describe the organizations and academic developments in the 20th century that you mentioned earlier, with the first Society of Anesthetists in London in 1893. And their objectives, you say, were to foster friendly relations between its members through debates, discussions, and scientific papers. Do you think that these objectives change over the course of the 20th century, or do you think that they largely adhere to them? Or how do you see that objectives shifting, or maybe those debates, how much do they become more relevant or hit on topics that are maybe more political than they were before?
Well, it's a very good point you raise, because the Society of Anesthetists, as you say, was really just to bring together the few practitioners that they were, because the number of, even though anesthesia appeared in the mid-1800s, the number of operations that were done under anesthesia didn't increase an awful lot. So the number of people who were giving anesthetics remained pretty small. So the Society of Anesthetists was a good idea to bring them together to discuss things. But they were then absorbed into what they call the Section of Anesthetics of the Royal Society of Medicine in 1908. And this was a bigger body, and nearly all the different specialties had sections within the Royal Society of Medicine. And this was the big forum back then at the beginning of the 20th century. However, the Royal Society of Medicine was strictly for, and still is to this day, strictly for scientific presenting of papers, discussions, and things like that on the actual technical aspects of their subjects. The new anesthetists realized that they had to negotiate on working conditions and pay, because they were being very poorly paid, and a lot of the times they weren't being paid at all, except what the surgeons would give them. So they weren't allowed to use the Royal Society of Medicine as a trade union, for want of a better word. So in 1932, Featherstone decided to set up a separate body, which he called the Association of Anesthetists. And he included Ireland in it. It was the Association of Anesthetists of Great Britain and Ireland. There was a lot of Irish anesthetists working over there, and vice versa. So this was a big step towards being recognized as a specialty in their own right. Now, the first thing they realized, they started negotiating on their pay and conditions of work, firstly, because a lot of them are just hired for 2 hours in the morning, maybe 2 days a week and things like that. And the rest of the time they had to work as general family practitioners to make a living. There was one member of Ivan McGill, who was an Irish anesthetist who worked all his career in England. He was very anxious that the Association of Anesthetists would push towards proper training and proper qualifications for anesthetists. And as a result of this, they approached the Royal Colleges in England to set up an exam. So in 1935, they held the first diploma in anesthesia, and it was called a conjoint diploma, because it was a conjoint between the Royal College of Physicians and the Royal College of Surgeons in England. So this finally gave anesthetists some sort of recognition as being a specialty, as having some skills and having exams. A similar exam took place then, following the example of the English. We set up a diploma here in 1942. And again, that was a conjoint diploma of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland, the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. They all had the royal titles. The next step, though, was the National Health Service in the UK came into being, I think it was 1948, and they would only pay you as a specialist if you had a higher qualification, but they didn't recognize the diploma in anaesthetics as a higher qualification. And by now, the English had set up their own college, they had set up the faculty of anaesthetists of the Royal College of Surgeons in England. So they then started a fellowship examination, a fellowship at the faculty of anaesthetists, Royal College of Surgeons in England. And that was recognized by the NHS as a specialty examination. And as a result, anaesthetists could now be paid as consultants within the NHS. In Ireland, we had, again, a bit like the Royal Society of Medicine, we had the Royal Academy of Medicine in Ireland, which was actually 20 years older than the Royal Society of Medicine. And the section of anaesthetics in that didn't start until 1946, and that was to commemorate 100 years since Morton's first anaesthetic. And then a few years later, in 1959-1960, the Royal College of Surgeons started up the Faculty of Anaesthetists, Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And they started, the first task that group had was to set up their specialty exam. So then they had their fellowship. And on a parallel track, the academic departments, again, this is important for recognition with your peers. The first academic department of anesthesia actually was in Wisconsin. And it appointed the first professor of anesthesia was Ralph Milton Waters. And he was appointed as early as 1927. And again, he had the same message. He wanted to give training to undergraduates. He wanted to give training to postgraduates in anesthesia and to, again, provide safe anesthesia, because you have people who were properly trained, who knew what they were doing, knew their physiology, their pharmacology. So that was the first one in the world. Was in Wisconsin in 1927. Over on this side of the Atlantic, Robert Reynolds McIntosh, who was actually a New Zealander, was appointed to Oxford for the first professorship in anaesthesia in Europe, was in Oxford, and that was in 1937. And they rapidly expanded in the UK. Over the next few years, they had more and more academic departments appearing around in Liverpool and London and places like that. It took a while for the same thing to happen here. The first academic department in Ireland was set up in Queen's University in Belfast in 1964 with the appointment of John Dundee, who was one of the leading lights in anaesthesia. And then the following year, the first professor was appointed down here in Southern Ireland in 1965, when Tommy Gilmartin was appointed as the Professor of Anaesthetics in Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. So that's how the academic departments, and that society changed, as you say, from starting off just to foster friendly relations, but it was really to bring people together. And of course, once you get together, you begin to get more powerful, or you begin to see what problems the other peoples are having, and that's how it evolved. So started with the society and ended up with the colleges. Which is a little different from the States, because I don't think there's the American Board of Anesthesiology, but I don't think either in Canada or the States that they have actual College of Anesthesiologists, you know. So that's how that's developed.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And you also discuss the Northern Ireland Anesthetics Group of the British Medical Association, which was also known as the Northern Ireland Society of Anesthetics, in Chapter 15. And again, you trace this kind of trajectory in the discussions that are taking place at these meetings, from things like epidural anesthesia during labor to anesthesia for the pair of cleft palates in infants and hypoxia and its management in aircraft. So the variety of topics, I think, gives at least readers who don't know much about anesthesia the complexity of administering anesthesia for a variety of different kinds of ailments. So I'm just interested, from a specialist like you, what do these topics indicate about how anesthesia was developed, or like how it was used? Do you see from this trajectory ways that anesthesia became used for things people hadn't maybe considered when it was first
developed? I thought that was interesting that you picked up on that, because that getting up to that Northern Ireland Public Records Office to find all that information was quite hazardous and tricky. But I was delighted I did it, because I know a lot of the Northern Ireland anesthetists. But I know I put in all the topics that they talked about at their meetings that I could find out about, because as you've pointed out, it shows the evolution of the specialty, how it's doing more and more and more from, you know, as you say, the epidural anesthesia in labor, the difficulties of doing cleft palates in infants. And if you look at the chapters on the Faculty of Anesthesia, two chapters on that, you can see from the annual congresses the way what topics became more and more topical as the years evolved from the 60s through to the 90s. There were huge changes, obviously, occurred in anesthesia in the 20th century. And a number of those were triggered by the world wars. They triggered a lot of changes, as you know, in medicine throughout. For instance, Sir Ivan McGill, again, this anesthetist I talked to you about, who was originally from County Down, he, after the First World War, he served in France during the First World War. After the First World War, they opened this hospital in the south of England called St. Mary's in Sidcup, I think, in Kent. And it was for treating facial injuries, for all the horrific facial injuries that the soldiers in the First World War had suffered from gas attacks and from shell attacks. So a lot of the operations were taking place in the face. And at that point, you administered an anesthetic by holding a mask over the face. So this was obviously not ideal when the surgeon is trying to operate in the face and you're holding the mask over the face. So Sir Ivan McGill started to put a rubber tube. The story about it is that he's wondering, how am I going to get the anesthetic down into the lungs and not have a mask in the face? And he saw they had a kettle in the tea room, and it was connected to a gas cylinder, a little gas ring. And he supposedly cut some of the tubing that ran from the gas cylinder to the gas ring and put that down the nose and insufflated the anesthetic down the nose. And then he realized if he gingerly manipulated this tube, he could actually get it between the vocal cords. So he basically developed endotracheal intubation, which we're all aware of. Even if you've never been in hospital, you've seen every movie going when they put down tubes. So he was able to put these tubes down, and now the surgeons could work away without interference from the anesthetist. And he was able to give the anesthetic and oxygen to the patient down the tube. So that was one huge development. And of course, that led later to the ability to ventilate patients. Another one that took place inadvertently, after Pearl Harbor, there was thousands of casualties, as you know. And they realized that a lot of these young, fit, healthy sailors who had been suffered trauma and were being operated on after the attack on Pearl Harbor died under anesthesia. And the reason they died was that they were hypovolemic and they had low blood pressure, and they died once they got the anesthetic. The American Army, and I presume the American population in general, realized they had a huge shortage of trained anesthesiologists. So they actually turned around and said, we're going to have to train a whole lot more anesthesiologists. And again, that lifted the specialty up. But suddenly people realized this is a very important specialty. Another significant step was the polio epidemic in the, I think, late 40s, early 50s. And When that the first center that really dealt with that was in Copenhagen, and they started to ventilate these patients because they realized that if they could ventilate them for so many days, and this was with iron lungs in those days, that they would recover from the polio and survive. So here you have anaesthetists ventilating these patients. They were doing it by hand at first, using a rubber bag and bagging them and taking them turns to do it for 24 hours a day. So this was really the start of critical care or intensive care. And again, it was the anesthesiologists who were doing it. Certainly here, you know, in Ireland, all 90% of intensivists are anesthesiologists by training, first of all. So we had the first critical care units opening up in Denmark, in Copenhagen. In Ireland, we had our first ones in both Belfast and Dublin opened in the 1960s. So now you find you have anaesthetists who are working in intensive care. Then we have people like Ron Melzack, whom I worked with in Montreal, who came up with the gate theory of pain. So you had the start of, this is back in the 80s, you have the start of the pain clinics. And so now you have pain medicine. So as a result now, our College of Anesthesiologists has two faculties. We have the Faculty of Pain Medicine and we have the Joint Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine, as well as just being the College of Anesthesiologists. So it shows how far the we've infiltrated the modern medicine.
Right, yeah. It's so fascinating to think about how, like, even just reading your book about how anesthesia developed, it's really interesting to think about how we now have so many more, it's so advanced in terms of how we manage pain. But you, to go back for a second to the meetings themselves, you mentioned in chapter 15 at the meeting of the Northern Ireland Society of Anesthetists in 1977, I think, that they had an extraordinary meeting to discuss the implications of the way that merit awards were allocated. And there was a note in that chapter that said that that noted that the lack of merit recognition had like really negative effect on the morale of anestheticists, so, like local ones. So can you say a little bit more about why this meeting is of particular significance?
Yeah, I'm surprised you spotted that little niche in there. It really only applied to Northern Ireland. This doesn't apply in the rest of Ireland because it was a feature of the National Health Service. So in the National Health Service, they had these the committee, a merit awards committee, and each year they would produce a couple of names of doctors whom they felt should have a merit award. Now, the merit award meant you got paid more money, and there was various levels of merit award, and it also meant your pension would be bigger. And this was in the NHS, so we're not talking only about Northern Ireland here. We never had merit awards in the rest of Ireland. Everybody was on a level playing field, whether they were a neurosurgeon or an anaesthetist. Everybody got the same pay. So what they pointed out that none of the anaesthetists were getting merit awards, and it was sort of a bit of a slap in the face, you know, why it was like, I presume they felt it was like we're a second-class citizen, and it really rankled. And the reason 1977 was at the peak of the troubles in Northern Ireland. This was when the bombing campaigns were going on. There was shootings. So these anaesthetists would have been dealing with severe major trauma. You know, every couple of nights they'd be in there working all night on trauma and gunshot wounds and everything. And they could easily just get in a boat and go over to England or Scotland, get the same pay, but not have all this hassle. So they were quite aggrieved, and they felt that they were losing talent. You're losing people because they weren't being recognised for it. That's all I can make out of it. I mean, I have no details saying that all of that happened, but that would be my interpretation of it, you know.
Yeah, because it was interesting. Like, I kept thinking about the troubles and how the dates, you know, were significant. And I think there's a brief mention of the troubles, but nothing really addressing the kinds of things that I'm sure the anesthetists were dealing with. You also mentioned that in May of 1959, the Faculty of anestheticists.
Anesthetists.
See, yeah. In America, we spell it differently.
Don't use the AE, you see.
Right, yeah. But you mentioned that the anesthetists would be the first ones. The faculty would be the first one created by the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. But then I was interested because there's mention of this recommendation that the South African Society of Anesthetists could send in names for consideration. And I wasn't clear, but there was no explanation as to why that could happen. So I was wondering what your theory is. Why was this suggested?
I don't know. You really did read this book. It really intrigued me, and I've asked several people in the Royal College of Surgeons, but of course none of them are around at this time, as to why they said that members of the South African Society should be allowed to become, what do they call them, adiundum fellows of the faculty. In other words, to be granted a fellowship without having to sit an exam. That was basically what it was, and that would mean they could come here. The only explanation or the only possible explanation, and I don't know if this is it, and I don't think if anybody can tell me, the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland is different from the Royal College of Surgeons in England or in Glasgow or in Edinburgh. There are three others, in that it has an undergraduate medical school. And it's a lot of its graduates, certainly back in those days, over 50% of its graduates would have been from abroad, from Asia and also from South Africa. So I can only conjecture that they were looking after their own graduates. Now, there had been a lot of strong links anyway with South Africa, and there's been a lot of to and fro of anaesthetists from here to South Africa and South Africa to here. We're on the same time zone, you see, which helps a lot. But nobody could actually give me the reason why they wanted so many. So that I did tot it up, but there were a number of South African anaesthetists then got, we call them honorary fellowships. In other words, they were granted a fellowship without examination. This happened in the first couple of years where they granted fellowships to normally senior anaesthetists who'd been working in the system for years and who weren't going to turn around and start sitting an exam now. So they were, in the first two or three years, there was lists of people who were going to get fellowships because of their status in society or their work with education or whatever. So this was what that was all about. But yes, it's an interesting thing to pick out. And it intrigued me too, but I have not been able to find the answer.
Right. Because is that kind of connected to then you further mentioned that the 1965 board adopts regulations and like training regulations, and that the Royal College of Surgeons in Australasia and the College of Surgeons in South Africa both wrote requesting reciprocity with the Irish faculty examinations. Does that also have to do with the same kind of relationship you're describing?
No. This is a different story, really. From the very start of the faculty in 1960, there were very close links with the English faculty. And if you read the chapter on the faculty, you'll find that some of what were really the leading lights of English or British anesthesia came to Dublin for the first exams. You had Pask, who was an incredible physiologist, came over for all the physiology exams. You had Mushin, who was the first professor in Wales, would come over. They all came over here and examined in the exam. And this gave, because you'd be worried about your first exam, you'd say, is this exam worth doing? Well, when your examiners are some of the best or best known anesthesiologists, we'll call it just to keep it simple, sitting across the desk from you, it gave it credibility. And they were always very supportive of the Irish College. So we had what we call the exchange examiner system. So, for instance, I only did it once. I went to London as the extern examiner. And in the exams in Dublin, there would always be one English or Scottish or Welsh extern examiner. And the extern examiner would always give a comment at the end of the exam on how he saw it was progressing, or whether he thought it was fair or good or up to standard or up to their standards. And we had to do the same thing when we went to London. So there was very good reciprocity, and he was very anxious to keep both bodies in parallel as regards the exams. For instance, if you sat in the early days of the exams, there were two parts. There was part one, which was physiology, pharmacology, and various bits, and then part two was clinical anesthesia, where you would actually have patients, and it was a bit like the final medical exam. So if I passed the primary, what we call the primary exam, the first exam in, we say, the UK, I could come and sit the fellowship in Ireland, and the reverse was true. So if you had the Irish fellowship primary, you could go and sit the English fellowship. So that was the first bit of, that was the reciprocity that started off initially. Then, as you pointed out, that in 1965, the Australasian College, again, the anaesthetists there were part of the Royal College of Surgeons of Australasia, just like we were the faculty of the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland. They asked for reciprocity. And again, it would have been similar. You could, it meant we recognized each other's qualifications. People would go and look at the exams and see if the exams were very similar, if the level was very similar. As I say, I examined in Ireland, I examined in England in the English College, and I actually sat the American boards. And I have to say that really the levels, all three were comparable, even if different, they were comparable. So there was reciprocity with Australia, and there was and that meant New Zealand as well. You know, they have a combined sort of colleges now, and also the South Africans. What happened with the United States? In 1981, the American Board of Anesthesiology recognized the fellowship again. They recognized the final fellowship as exempting you from the first part of the American boards. And that's actually what I did. I didn't have to sit the first part of the American boards. I was able to, after you had to do 1 year in a training post in the States, and you were allowed to sit the American boards. And as I say, it was very similar to the exams I'd sat here anyway. So that's the that's all gone now, by the way. The first place to pull out of reciprocity was the United States. So it doesn't recognize it anymore. So, and I'm not really up to date beyond that, but I do know reciprocity disappeared a good while back. The other thing I'd like to say is that the training in Ireland and in the UK is controlled by the colleges. So the College of Anaesthetists of Ireland and the College of Anaesthetists in the UK. And so you apply to the colleges for a training program, and then you're rotated through various hospitals. So you go to a general hospital, then pediatrics, obstetrics, critical care, cardiac, neuro. Because in Ireland, we have two neuro hospitals, we have two cardiac hospitals. So if you wanted experience, you have to move to those. And also, you get experience in pain and regional anesthesia. Now, 40 years ago, when I worked in Boston, the training was coordinated basically by Harvard, and the American Board of Anesthesiologists had the overarching role. And it was the same in McGill in Montreal. McGill controlled the training program. You rotated within McGill. So I presume it's just a matter of scale, because Ireland is so small that we control the whole thing from one college. And in the States, I guess, each state has its own licensing, so each state would have its own. But the overall standard, I presume, is controlled by the ABA. But you know, I don't know what's happening nowadays. I presume it's still pretty much the same. So there you go.
Well, which is interesting, considering the reciprocity idea seems to make a lot of sense in terms of developing a larger specialty and a larger kind of exchange. But America's generally the first one to abandon these things, unfortunately. And you also trace, so I think you referenced this earlier, actually, the transformation in chapter 19, you talk about the transformation of the faculty of
to an independent college.
Independent college. So can you say just a little bit about why that's important, for particularly for medical education and training?
Yeah. Well, before I go back to the reciprocity, I mean, it's still very important for us, because, for instance, an awful lot of Irish anesthesia graduates go to Australia and do critical care fellowships there, because Australia in Ireland is regarded as the sort of the mecca for critical care. But they recognize the Irish fellowship, so it makes it easy for our doctors to go and work there. My son works in Australia now, and he's a consultant there. But they recognize our qualifications. We recognize theirs. So we have Australians coming here to work, and we have Irish going to Australia to work. And that's very beneficial for everybody. You know, as we talked about her beforehand about the cross-pollination and how you learn something from somewhere else. To talk about the transformation of the faculty of the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland to an independent college, this was a huge step, actually. And it was a huge step for the specialty because it took anaesthetists in their final step away from their surgical colleagues. Now, we work with them, obviously, every day of the week, but in a more philosophical way. See, the early anaesthetists were often, you know, I'm talking about the end of the 19th century now, not talking about the 20th century. They were often trainee surgeons. So if you were a trainee surgeon, you would give the anaesthetic and the surgeon, your boss would be given doing the surgery. And after a while, then you'd be doing the surgery and somebody else would be given the anaesthetic. So in the eyes of the public, an anaesthetist, if you were a full-time anaesthetist, you were probably a failed surgeon. So it wasn't a good position to be in. And actually, I remember people saying that to me even back in the 70s. You're training to be a surgeon, you're doing anaesthetics. So it hadn't disappeared. So it took years to get away from the idea of the surgeon, of the anaesthetist being subservient to the surgeon. Now, again, if you look at the chapter on the Northern Ireland Society of Anaesthetists, you see that the anaesthetists were paid by the surgeon. So if the surgeon got 20 guineas, he might give the anaesthetist one guinea. So it talked about the crumbs from the surgeon's table. Now, that was a very bad situation to be in, because if you didn't want to, if you felt the patient wasn't fit for surgery, and you kept telling the surgeon that you didn't want to put that patient to sleep, he'd probably drop you pretty quick and you might lose your livelihood. So it was a terrible situation to be in. So this continued, you know, again, if you look at the chapter in Northern Ireland Society of Anaesthetists, you'll see that 50% of the people who were in the society were actually general practitioners. And then they went to hospital for so many mornings a week, and they gave anaesthetics in the morning, and then they went back to their family practice in the afternoon, and that's where they made the bulk of their money. So they couldn't get a living from giving anaesthetics. So that all changed firstly in 1948 with the advent of the National Health Service. And as I said, they needed to have the higher qualification to get the full specialist payments that were coming from them. Then if we talk about the actual faculty of anaesthetists, there was a lot of irritation on a number of ways in which they weren't independent. For instance, the conferring of the fellowship. So you're now about to confer somebody with a fellowship in anaesthesia of the Faculty of Anaesthetists of the Royal College of Surgeons. It was the president of the Royal College of Surgeons who conferred the conferees. And there's one photograph in the book of that famous doctor down in Dallas who resuscitated John F. Kennedy, receiving an honorary fellowship. And the president of the College of Surgeons is sitting there with his mace in front of him. So he's the one who's actually conferring the fellowship. Then the next thing they were doing, which annoyed Professor Dundee from Belfast no end, was that they were appointing the examiners. Now, obviously, the faculty would say, we want to have this guy and this guy. But it was still the College of Surgeons who said, yes, you can be an examiner. No, you can't. So these dependencies, and then finally, as a faculty, their incomes were regulated by the College of Surgeons. So all of these things drove the need for them to become an independent faculty. Shortly after, so in 1998, they finally became an independent college. So they broke away from the Royal College of Surgeons. Now, I have to say, the last few presidents of the Royal College of Surgeons were very supportive in this drive towards independence, you know, and things had changed, times had changed, things had moved on. And the first fellowship was conferred on Mary McAleese, who was president of Ireland at the time. Shortly after that, the final step, I would have said, in the road to independence was they purchased their own building at 22 Merrion Square, which is an area I had particular interest in. This is one of the things I got involved because I was very interested in the history of the house. And this is it's one of the finest Georgian, it probably is the finest Georgian square in Dublin, and it's close to government buildings, the art gallery. So it's right at the center of things. And as I say, there's a whole chapter on that. This was a very significant step. And then, as I said earlier, now houses the College of Anaesthetists and its faculties, which is the Faculty of Pain Medicine and the Joint Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine. And it really does show, and we have our simulators there, simulating operating rooms and everything. So it shows how anaesthesia has now expanded to be its own college and also to, you know, expand it into intensive care and pain medicine and so on. So that's the story there. That's why it was so important to break away.
Right.
And now it's 25 years now, next year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. College. Yeah. So that'll be the next task.
Right. Well, it's so interesting, especially now, I think, maybe, I don't know if it's exactly the same in Ireland, but now anesthesiologists is such a profitable field. I think that a lot of, you know, it's such a difficult, I think, specialty because it's so complex. You need to know so much about not only the anatomy of the body, but also the way that the chemicals and drugs are interacting with it. That it's interesting to hear that it was initially seen as like lesser than a surgeon, and now it's at least equal, if not maybe regarded a little bit. Well, I suppose equally. I would say equally to surgeons, but I don't know. Is that the same in Ireland?
Yeah, but I should say really that one of the big steps that I think happened, it came out of Harvard, was called the Harvard Minimum Monitoring Standards. And this recommended that you use pulse oximetry, electrocardiograph, blood pressure measuring, and esophageal stethoscope on all patients. And once it was printed, once it was published out of Harvard, out of the Beth Israel, actually, where I work, it became universal. And it was another step in making anesthesia so much safer, you know. So yeah, monitoring is a big thing now, you know. It's so complex now, it's like the flight deck of a Boeing whatever.
Right, yeah, it's incredibly complex. So my last question is just, what do you hope that readers take away from the book? I mean, it's such a fascinating book, but are there any areas in the history of anesthesia, because I think this book gives such a great kind of overview of the development of anesthesia in Ireland. But are there any areas that you would like to see developed by scholars, or any particular figures that you think deserve further merit, further research?
Yeah, an interesting question. Well, what I hope the readers see from the book is obviously what you've just said there, how the specialty of anesthesia evolved from the early days of ether anesthetics to the modern day specialty, which involves so many areas of hospital medicine. I'd like them to see how from the earliest days in the 1850s, the practitioners of this art were so concerned about the safety of their patients, with all these committees looking at the complication rates from ether and the complication rates from chloroform and the death rates that were occurring, and why were these deaths occurring, and what was, you know, were people using the right equipment for it? Some people were using handkerchiefs, some people were using complex equipment to give chloroform, for instance. So there was all this debate going on all the time. And the same thing happened with the introduction of regional anesthesia and, of course, with all the drugs. So this concern for patient safety, that led to the development, of course, of the initial training programs. We saw that with Ivan McGill in the UK and the Association of Anaesthetists of Great Britain and Ireland, and of course with Ralph Waters in Wisconsin. So they all realized that a properly trained specialist was going to be a safer specialist and was going to make anaesthesia safer for everybody all around. And again, as I said, the monitoring standards then that came out of Harvard, they made a huge difference. They dropped anesthesia from one of the highest risk specialties as regards the insurance companies down to one of the safest specialties. So with modern day monitoring and with highly trained specialist doctors, anesthesia is now one of the safest specialties in a hospital for our patients. And that's why we have the title of the book. People say, what's the title? Safety as we watch, because that's really the core. We have to get our patients safely through this. We have to get them out. Obviously, we have to keep them pain-free and asleep, they don't have to be asleep, but they have to be pain-free. But we've got to get them through this trauma. I mean, surgery is trauma. So get them through it safely. Finally, for future research, I discussed this with Declan yesterday. What areas did we think we would like to see? And he said that really the one area that we don't know is what is the societal impact of anesthesia? But none of us have the expertise for that. That would be a different type of expert to come and say what the societal impact is of anesthesia.
Right, which would be a very fascinating study, I think, especially there are accounts of patients' experiences of anesthesia that are really interesting, particularly in terms of the, I guess, the taste of ether kind of lingers, or the smell of it, like lingers after use, at least from the accounts that I read. So it's interesting to, I think that's definitely a really interesting area for further research. So I guess that's all left to say is thanks, Joe. It was really great to talk to you. I highly recommend
my pleasure.
Okay, great. And then I highly recommend anyone who's listening to this go out and buy themselves a copy of Safety as We Watch. I think it's particularly going to be of interest to medical professionals, anesthesiologists, but also perhaps more important, well, not more importantly, but as importantly, scholars and students studying the history of medicine and medical and health humanities more broadly.